Welcome to WMNF's Midpoint, and joining me today are two scientists, two experts on sea level rise. Why don't you introduce yourselves, please?
Hi, I'm Erica Spanger-Siegfried, Senior Analyst with the Union of Concerned Scientists Climate and Energy Program.
And I am Astrid Caldas. I am a Senior Climate Scientist with the Climate and Energy Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists also.
And the Union of Concerned Scientists has put out a report about rising sea levels. It says, when rising seas hit home, and this is about sunny day flooding and which coastal communities will be affected and how they'll be affected. So why don't we start at the very beginning? Why are seas rising and what's the cause of it?
Sea levels are going up because they are deeply connected with the increase in temperatures in the atmosphere. So as the atmosphere warms up, the sea levels also go up because they absorb a lot of the warm of the atmosphere. And that way they get their volume higher and they increase in volume. They have nowhere to go but up. There are also other factors like the melting of land-based ice, like glaciers and ice sheets. But so far, most of it has been this thermal expansion, as we call it. It gets bigger with heat.
We've seen some sunny day flooding is what we call it here in Florida when it's not raining, but the streets start to flood. Why is that? What's happening?
That's what, because of the high tide. We with the sea levels, the old level, the old limit that the high tide reached is now higher. So the places that didn't get flooded at that high tide are now getting flooded because the high tide is riding on a sea level that's up to 12 inches higher than it was a century ago.
Why don't you talk about your report that when rising seas hit home, for the whole United States, for all the coastal communities, is there a generalization that you can make?
Yes, that chronic flooding, so not areas being permanently underwater at high tide, but a chronic kind of flooding, flooding that disrupts day-to-day life, flooding that makes business as usual in certain areas impossible, is coming sooner than most of us think to much of the coast.
And one of the reasons that we're seeing things accelerating is, I mean, we've seen higher temperatures. The last 4 years, we just found out this month that the last 4 years have been the hottest on record. Why are they getting hotter? What's the cause of that?
We know that the increase in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is directly correlated with the increase in temperature in the atmosphere. The relation between carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas, which means it warms up the atmosphere, the relationship between carbon dioxide or CO2 and temperature has been known since the end of the 19th century, and it's a very straightforward relationship. So as the carbon dioxide goes up, up goes the temperature also. There are also other greenhouse gases that contribute, but the main one that's driving this warming of the atmosphere is the carbon dioxide.
Astrid also mentioned that the oceans have absorbed a lot of the warmth that has been caused by this increased greenhouse effect. In fact, it's something on the order of 93% of the excess heat has been absorbed by the ocean, which is really tremendous when you think about it. The atmosphere would be a lot hotter. We would be a lot warmer were it not for that.
So if just experientially, if you're experiencing that the air feels hotter these days, the oceans are even feeling it more than humans on, you know, in the atmosphere are feeling it.
That's correct.
Our guests are Astrid Caldas with the Union of Concerned Scientists and Erica Spanger-Siegfried with the Union of Concerned Scientists as well. And we're talking about sea level rise and sunny day flooding and a new report that the center has come up with, when rising seas hit home. And of course, with Florida, with all of its coastline, is one of the states that's going to be affected the most by sea level rise this century. According to your report, we're going to be looking at some numbers soon where we're looking at what's going to happen, you know, by 2100 and even sooner, or what are the potential things that could happen. So tell us what we know about Florida and rising seas.
We have found that in Florida, many communities that currently already see some high tide flooding are going to be seeing this level of chronic inundation towards the half of the century, we have that we evaluated this high tide flooding chronic inundation under two different scenarios of sea level rise. One is an intermediate scenario, which is more conservative and projects 4 feet of sea level rise globally, not locally here, by the end of the century. And a higher scenario, which projects about 6 feet of sea level rise by the end of the century globally. Locally, those levels are going to be different, but they, more or less to give you an idea between the two scenarios. And we found that in Florida, just in 20 years, less than 20 years, by 2035, under the intermediate scenario, we're going to have 5 communities that are going to meet this threshold of being inundated at least 26 times per year or every other week on average. And that inundation is going to occur over at least 10% of their usable land, not considering the wetlands. So those are 5 communities, and I should highlight that communities are not always a town that you recognize. Most of the times it is, but we used census county subdivisions, which are available online. If you look at what county subdivision your town is, you can check out those data. But under the high scenario, by 2035, the number jumps from 5 communities to 18 communities. It's a big difference on the scenario. If the sea levels go up faster, the number of the communities significantly higher. And then those numbers go up even more. By 2060, by mid-century, we'll find 18 communities chronically inundated under the intermediate scenario, but 32 under the high scenario. So the difference is quite striking, and it's certainly a significant number of communities.
So that would be 32 communities across the state.
Across the state of Florida.
That you would expect that every year, on average, every other week or so, there would be flooding that, you know, would disrupt whatever's happening in that part of the town. Like we're used to seeing in Miami Beach these days.
Like clockwork. Yeah. High tide comes. It's not like a hurricane or a rainstorm. It comes every day. So when it's higher.
Yeah, I would add that that kind of chronic flooding, that frequency of flooding, will be affecting many more communities in Florida, just in more isolated, smaller areas. But it's important to bear in mind that Miami Beach is investing nearly $500 million to cope with flooding that covers a far, far smaller area than the 10% threshold that we're talking about. So really, it can take flooding over, you know, just very limited locations. But if those locations are important to the local economy, to housing, to commuting, they can cause tremendous disruption and drive really significant choices and investments. And we were trying to capture that so that communities and decision makers can really see this coming and get out ahead of it.
What are some things that people can do? You hear this word resiliency, and some of the ideas they're doing are things like raising the levels, the elevation of roads and so forth, maybe building seawalls. That's not going to keep back the seas forever. There's also talk about communities moving, not building any longer on barrier islands, for example, if that might be a solution, or taking people who are in these flood-prone areas and moving them somewhere else. So why don't you lay out what some of the strategies are for resiliency?
Sure. It's difficult, if not impossible, to tell any specific community what the right solutions are for them. Those things, you know, adaptation is going to need to be something that's designed and planned and implemented locally. But when we think about responding to sea level rise, adapting to it, there are kind of 3 major buckets that we have to draw from. The first one, and the one that, you know, just by human nature we're inclined to go to right off the bat, is the defensive bucket. You know, what measures can we bring online to keep the water out? Those are usually hard defenses, seawalls, levees, that kind of thing. They can also be green infrastructure. You know, things like oyster reefs to slow waves, or, you know, enhanced wetlands to keep the water out. It can also be accommodation. We can implement measures simple. It's certainly a real problem for the homeowner, but it's relatively straightforward to elevate homes and get them, you know, just up and out of the way of water. We can also, you know, implement some more creative solutions, like creating channels that allow a community to really absorb water without it completely, you know, overrunning places that we prefer would stay dry. And then the third approach is the one that we're most resistant to, understandably, and that is retreating from places that we currently inhabit. We will need to be considering that in some locations that prove to just be too expensive or technically difficult to keep the water out of. Those are the three major buckets. Any community is going to be drawing from those buckets in different ways at different times. And it's important, I think, for communities that have a limited amount of time before this kind of chronic flooding arrives to think boldly, you know, and to draw on those options that are, you know, bigger and bolder ideas, including in some cases getting things out of the way of water in the form of retreat. Other communities will have a longer time frame for, you know, for planning, to thinking long term about investments that could be made to accommodate the water. Any plan will be unique to that community, but the important thing is to start thinking about it.
And these are ideas for adapting to the problems that will arise because of sea level rise. But there's also some things that a community could do, or even if it's a global community, are trying to stay ahead of the curve and reduce greenhouse gases in the first place. How would that affect the plans for adapting?
The warming that we're seeing today in the atmosphere and the sea level rise that we're seeing today are a consequence of past actions. They are a consequence of emissions that happened in the past. And those kind of baked these increases for the future, because carbon dioxide stays a long time, 100 years or more in the atmosphere, and it keeps warming. And the sea levels are rising because it's kind of responding, you know, to that in a way, give or take, but it there is a big response from that. As Erica mentioned, 93% is absorbed. However, what we do now is going to be influencing the sea level and the global warming towards the end of the century. So it is essential, though, that those measures that we call mitigation measures for reducing the number of emissions of these greenhouse gases that can increase temperature and consequently increase sea level, it's essential that they are reduced. And that's many measures like the Global Paris Agreement and local initiatives by countries and states at the different levels, states setting targets for clean energy and renewables on their portfolio and reducing emissions in transportation and all the infrastructure. All these count. And together, collectively, hopefully it will make an impact, but it has to be a concerted effort.
If I could make an analogy, it's almost as if, let's say you have a very serious credit card debt. You might think about, how are you going to pay off this credit card debt? Maybe I'll make this kind of monthly payment amount. But the very, you know, maybe one of the most important things would be to stop spending yourself into debt. So it's kind of like this carbon debt that we're having to kind of think about.
Yeah, if you're in a hole, stop digging.
I was going to say, that's a good analogy. If you're in the hole, stop digging.
Yeah, and I think it's important for us to bear in mind also, as Astrid said, there's tremendous inertia in the sea level rise, you know, phenomenon, and it's going to continue to rise in coming decades, really, regardless of what we do right now. It is the latter part of the century and beyond. Though, and our actions this century could determine sea level rise for centuries to come, potentially quite significant sea level rise if we don't do enough.
I want to look at some specific communities that you've mentioned in this report, and you're not from the Tampa Bay area, so I'll read these communities and our listeners will be familiar with where they are, even if you're not, but you can at least tell us what would it mean for this community. For example, under the intermediate scenario, by 2060, 15% of the community of St. Pete Beach will be inundated, you on average, once every 2 weeks.
That is correct. You're reading it correctly. And we also have the information that we evaluated, that some parts of St. Pete's already flood, and you probably know that, but it just hasn't reached the threshold of 10% until 2060. That's when it becomes this approximate 15%. And I would like to mention that this number that we estimate is independent of any storm surge or any rainfall or any adaptation measures. If they build something, if they do any of these measures from any of these buckets that Erica mentioned, this number will definitely change.
How did you get to these numbers? Did you look at elevations of the land?
Yes, we did. We used three major publicly available data sets. We used the 92 tide gauges that are arrayed along the U.S. coastline. So this analysis is for the entire lower 48 coast, and we use those tide gauges maintained by NOAA, our National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. We used digital elevation models, which are sort of high-resolution topographical maps along our coasts, also provided to us by NOAA. And we used sea level rise scenarios developed by NOAA and used in the National Climate Assessment, but also localized by the Army Corps of Engineers. So there is global sea level rise, but it's actually rising differently at different locations around the world, depending on unique local factors, like is the land sinking? Are there, you know, important currents driving higher sea levels? A range of things that can drive sea levels higher or slower, lower. So we combine those things. We know that communities aren't going to wait till they're underwater at high tide. So we wanted to find a frequency that was meaningful at a local level, a frequency of flooding that was disruptive enough to be useful in planning. So we spoke with flooded communities from Miami to Charleston to Annapolis to Queens, you know, and got a sense of what frequency really drove them to make major investments. We spoke to experts and we came up with this frequency of 26 times per year. And then it was really just simply a matter of looking at the tide gauge data. 20 years of tide gauge data, it's recorded every 6 minutes, and we could look at the level that was exceeded on average 26 times a year. And then it's a matter of adding sea level rise projections to that, seeing the extent of land that's inundated currently 26 times at that 26 times per year level, and then adding local sea level rise onto it. And what we were able to do with these sea level rise projections is look sooner in time. So look at 2030, what would be inundated? 2035, what area would be inundated out to the end of the century?
For people who aren't as familiar about tides, I maybe should bring in the 26 times a year, that's roughly every other week, which is significant in when it comes to tides, because tides are at their highest and at their lowest during the full moon and during the new moon, which occur every 2 weeks, roughly. The times when the tides would be the highest are these times when you would expect the inundation, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and some of the tides will be higher than others. So maybe at a very high tide, there will be 3 days of chronic inundation. Mm-hmm. And then when it's not that high, there won't be any. So that's why we say on average.
So even if it's saying roughly once every 2 weeks, it doesn't necessarily just mean for an hour or two. It could be for...
It could be, yeah. And it could be at any depth, and it could mean a lot of disruption, as you can imagine. Can you imagine every other week, like your house or the road that you have to go through every day, it's flooding every... Oh, my God, it's flooded again. I can't get to work. Oh, my God, the school bus cannot get here because it's flooded again.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing that we found in low-lying areas, that over time, the percentage of a community's usable land area that gets chronically inundated grows dramatically. So, you know, this isn't the case for all communities, but those that aren't endowed with significant elevation see large shares of their community flooding on a chronic basis. You know, we see 60, 70, 80% over the course of the century.
If there's someone who's in public policy, maybe they're an elected official or maybe they work in city planning or something, and they're hearing this conversation or they're reading your report, what would you hope that the message that they would take to their government, what kind of action should be happening right now?
Well, if they don't have an adaptation plan or a planning process, they need to put that in place. They need to demand that and to initiate that process as a community conversation with community input. It's the kind of thing that needs to involve all of the – when you think about the ways in which a community is exposed to sea level rise, there are a lot of them. You know, it's transportation, it's stormwater, it's sewer, it's the school system because kids need to get to and from. It can be a whole range of things. So certainly all of the municipal departments that are implicated, but it needs to be a community conversation because people's homes and commutes and, you know, sort of livelihoods, potentially where they work, are also implicated.
But it can be a very touchy political issue because, you know, the issue of climate change, the issue of what to do about climate change somehow has gotten politicized, and there's entire parties that are in control sometimes in Washington, D.C. or in Tallahassee, Florida, that, you know, don't want to talk about this and don't want to prepare.
That's right. But we believe that the issue of sea level rise in particular is a gateway conversation to the broader climate change conversation. And we are seeing progress even in Washington, where we have this Climate Solutions Caucus, that it's a bipartisan caucus that was initiated by a Florida representative, and it is a Noah's Ark. They only come in pairs, one Democrat, one Republican, and it's up to 66 members right now, right? And the idea is that to have a conversation about climate change and to work whatever legislation and anything that is related to climate change, they can have a word and they can work towards it. But it has to actually get to action, you know, because right now there's hasn't seen much action, but it's a good start because they're coming together. So we hope that this is a good beginning of the conversation, because sea level rise is an issue that the data are showing and people cannot really deny. It's hard to deny that the seas are rising.
Yeah, I would add to that sea level rise, for better or worse, is also a really visible problem. So it's no coincidence that it was Carlos Corbello and another Florida representative who were responsible for starting the Climate Solutions Caucus. And it's no coincidence that Southeast Florida, the Miami area, is considered a global hotspot for sea level rise and sees very frequent, very visible and disruptive tidal flooding. You know, those things are closely connected.
Tell me the connection between sea level rise and environmental justice.
We know historically that low-income and minority communities are the ones that have the hardest time rebounding whenever a disaster hits. They lack the resources, and sometimes, like we saw during Katrina, for instance, they were kind of left behind because of the, you know, they wanted to help other people and other neighborhoods. So there is always this fine line where people need to pay attention to these equity issues. They need to pay attention to these people who need it the most. But at the same time, these people who need it the most don't bring much to the community in terms of tax returns, in terms of, you know, a lot of things that people shouldn't but do think about first. And we know that lots of minorities in low-income populations already live in areas that are more vulnerable also. They are already exposed to more levels of pollution. They are already exposed to different levels. When disaster hits, they don't have as many protections like the seawalls, for instance, that some of the wealthier areas have. So it is a deep issue, and maybe Erica has something to say.
I guess I would just add that our shorthand is that they are hit first and worst, and if we're going to get serious about adaptation and get serious about mobilizing federal resources to invest in the smart policies that we know can reduce risk, like, you know, the pre-disaster mitigation planning, we have to make sure that that money is directed toward the communities that need it the most. You know, at the moment, we've been spending a disproportionate amount of money on the houses that are repeatedly flooded and repeatedly rebuilt. And, you know, we understand how we got here. But going forward, we need to do this much more thoughtfully.
There was a story that our listeners may have heard that we played from a radio station in the Miami area, WLRN, where they were reporting that there's the affordable housing in communities in the Miami area, the low-income areas where there is affordable housing, are also some of the higher and drier places. And as there are more and more climate refugees, I guess you would say, people that are retreating from the sea level rise, coming from the beaches, they want to find some place to live, they're coming into these low-income communities and gentrifying them. What can you say about the process of gentrification of low-income communities as a result of sea level rise?
Well, it would sort of be adding insult to injury, you know, that these the waterfront properties that have been, you know, inaccessible, the beachfront that's been hard for low-income people in these, you know, more inland neighborhoods to access and enjoy, now seeing folks retreating and being displaced by higher rents, it's an obvious instance of climate injustice, of inequity. And what's promising, though, is to hear, you know, we're just seeing the very, very beginning of this, what could potentially become a pretty significant phenomenon. But there's a conversation happening about it. You know, there's awareness about it. And there's the potential, you know, with the climate, with an active climate justice community to get out ahead of this and to find ways to push back.
So far, we've talked mostly about the effect on individuals, but what about the effect on businesses of this sea level rise? What can businesses learn from this conversation?
We have seen already several places that don't even reach this threshold that we mentioned of 10%, like Annapolis, starting to deal with this flooding in a serious manner. They have a climate-ready project, which is a climate action plan in Annapolis. And they are one, I think, of the first communities to have the business community insurance, where the businesses have insurance for when it floods, the business that they lose cannot affect them as deeply because they can be covered, because the losses can be really staggering. In a place like Annapolis, that is a big tourist place, and like that many others, if you lose 2-3 days of business per month, it's a huge impact. So businesses have been coming around, and I'll let Erica speak more about that because she's more informed on that front. But businesses have been coming around about the risks of climate change, and they are incorporating those risks in their planning. And Erica?
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to add, but certainly we're seeing in a number of these kind of sea level rise front line cities, business communities, particularly businesses that are most exposed, like in Boston, the coastal development and you know, real estate community, organizing and putting together, you know, best practice plans for dealing with sea level rise. And you're seeing really practical things like elevating critical utilities up from the first floor to upper floors. There's no reason not to do it. And there's a good reason to do it because those things are flooded and your whole heating and cooling systems can go out. We're seeing some businesses install these sort of rapidly deployable temporary seawall systems because the flooding is becoming so frequent along the Boston waterfront. So there are kind of stopgap measures that we're seeing businesses take to sort of buy time. And then there are the kind of practical longer-term things that we're seeing them doing. But it's just a start. And really, I think as the business community gets a better handle on the long-term exposure to, you know, some of the really important commercial areas and industrial areas, we're going to see them put more long-term, bigger thinking plans in place, including presumably some relocation, including presumably some really heavy investment in defensive measures to stay in place. Just a couple of weeks ago, Boston saw Winter Storm Grayson, and a very, very large area that's heavily developed and being increasingly heavily developed for business and industry, completely flooded. And our projections show that that should be expected on a, you know, biweekly basis in the decades to come. Boston, while it's getting ahead of a problem like this, needs to get much more serious about what it's allowing in terms of development and what it's requiring in terms of protection.
Is there a time when a community, you know, obviously it would change from community to community, but you would look at the data, you'd look at the maps, you would look at the projections of sea level rise and just say, in this area of town, we just can't build anymore. We used to build high rises here. We used to build waterfront homes here. We just can't build, for example, on these barrier islands.
That's right. That's one of the things that we advocate and that we tell people. There are some things that are in place that really need to change. And among them, zoning and development should really take, developers should really take a hard look at those locations. City planners should really take a hard look and decide, maybe it's not such a great idea to build here anymore. I mean, we already have all these houses here and all this stuff. Let's try to move something else and not really allow this type of risky development that can only increase the problem.
But I've talked to politicians, and maybe understandably, you can imagine that when you say something like that, that in our most beautiful parts of the beaches or something, to not have development there, one of the things that I remember them saying is that we'll let the insurance market take care of that. There will be a point at which the insurance will be so high, because the insurance companies obviously are thinking about this, that it'll just get too expensive, and then that way people won't build there. Or should it be a policy thing?
Yeah. We would hope that the changes along the coastline could be the result of thoughtful policies that get out ahead of any, you know, real kind of real shocks, right? Real shocks to the coastal real estate market. Real shocks to, you know, local commerce and the local economy. We have all kinds of really important actors that are involved in supporting the coastal real estate market. We've got the mortgage lenders, we've got the insurers, we've got the reinsurers, we have the investment community that, you know, supports municipal bonds. Each one of those players, and there are others that I haven't even thought to name, have a lot at stake. They have a lot of skin in the game. And if the risk at the community level is allowed to just continue to grow, their incentive to pull back is also going to grow. They're going to, at some point, you know, I don't know who, I don't know which one is going to decide, we can't, this risk is too much. And when that happens, you know, a cascade of really negative things can happen. So it's important to get out ahead of that and to start building resilience and putting sensible policies in place so we don't see the sort of, you know, bottom drop out the way we have in the past. Because importantly, when the bottom drops out along the coastal real estate market, you know, unlike past instances when it has slowly climbed back out, it isn't going to climb back out.
That's right.
So gradually letting the air out of this bubble is really important to do.
And I would add one thing that, you know, you just kind of, oh, the insurance, you know, so eventually these places are not going to be insurable. Well, then they're not going to be sellable. So that cascading effect that Erica is talking about, I mean, it can really have a huge impact.
Well, Astrid Caldas and Erica Spanger Siegfried from the Union of Concerned Scientists, is there anything else that we should leave our listeners with from this discussion?
I would highlight again about our decisions within the next couple of decades, that how important they are for our future, particularly of the coastal communities. And I would encourage all of the listeners to try to get engaged in local efforts. There is an effort currently going on here in this area to create a climate compact, which is a group of counties working together in cities to come up with robust solutions. And I would encourage the citizens to get involved in that effort.
Yeah, I strongly agree. And our results can be discouraging to look at and to dig into. But, you know, that's the big picture. We're all practical people, and our role really is to kind of, you know, put our head down and get to work and stay at work. And these outcomes are not foregone conclusions. There are curves that we can bend if we are working hard at it.
Well, great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.